Well, good afternoon again, everyone. It's certainly a delightful time to an exciting opportunity to live through the events of the day. Well, today I want to speak about the individuality of our calling to become Christians. And I'll get into the title a little bit later. 1,000 years from the fall of Rome, around 500 AD of the Roman Empire, to the year 1500, is known as the Dark Ages. Now, it has two other names. It's called the Medieval Time Period or the Middle Ages. The Dark Ages were 1,000 years in which Europe and the world stagnated without advancements in agriculture, industry, health, and communication. And people were largely subsistence, meaning that they had to grow and preserve their own food. They made their own clothes and built their own shelters. It was a kind of a one-on-one existence in trying to survive. Castles were built to protect local people from invaders. Infant mortality was very high, and lifespans were generally short. Life was hard. And then around the year 1500, just 500 years ago, the world began to wake up. First came improvements in agriculture, and when people's bellies were full, they had time to explore other ideas and things. New ships were designed that would travel farther and faster. In fact, in 1492, we all know the story of this Genoese or Italian sailor named Columbus sailed from Europe to the New World, and it opened up commerce between the Americas and Europe and Africa. This period, around the year 1500, is called the Enlightenment in English, but in French, they refer to it as the time of the Renaissance, which is the awakening. It was as if the world had been sleeping for 1,000 years and was now waking up. And many of us in school, we read about Galileo, an Italian astronomer and physicist who was born in 1564. And he experimented with gravity by dropping two different sizes of iron balls from the Leaning Tower of Pisa. To everyone's surprise, although the iron balls were of different size and weight, they both hit the ground at the same time. And of course, Galileo was experimenting with this concept of gravity. Well, it was less than 100 years later, another scientist you may have heard of in England was named Sir Isaac Newton, and he formalized our understanding of the law of gravity. And he put it this way: any object that having mass attracts other object, and this force of attraction is called gravity. This is a universal phenomenon, meaning it's true everywhere. Gravity is the same here in Arkansas as it is in Europe, or Asia, or South America, or any place else on Earth. In fact, gravity is also true on the Moon, Mars, Jupiter, every place else, not just in our solar system, but throughout the universe. It is what we would call a law of nature. Now, Galileo and Newton didn't invent gravity. They helped formalize our understanding of the law of gravity. And most of us came to an abrupt understanding and an education of gravity when we learned to walk when we were about 10 months of age. Crash, boom, and then you get up and you try it again. It was when my eldest daughter was about that age, I was sitting in the living room on the sofa and reading a newspaper, and I looked up. Now, we had purchased one of these little plastic trains that a child could, with a handle on the back, it could push along, or they could sit on it and you could push them. And so she was used to either having rides on it, or she couldn't really walk on her own, but she could push this little train engine, plastic. And I looked up, and to my shock, the little plastic train was on its side in the living room, and she was standing on the train on the wheel. So it was very unstable, and to help her stabilize, she had her hand out, holding the arm of the rocking chair, which was also unstable. And I'm looking at this in shock, knowing that my poor little child is going to crash and things aren't going to sound well. I was able to rescue her there, but she was in the process of discovering gravity on her own, as did each of us. Now, we call this phenomenon of gravity a law because it's always true, no matter where we go and what we do. Well, from the Age of Enlightenment forward, many of us, or the people, have discovered what the world calls the laws of nature. And we know these laws are put in place prior to the creation of mankind. The laws of nature are rules by which everything operates. The laws of nature do not extend only to the physical realm, such as gravity, inertia, velocity, resistance, chemical reactions, and the like. The laws of nature include animal behavior and human behavior. We have about 20 chickens, and chickens have a flock instinct. They will naturally group together by choice. If you separate them out and put one every 100 feet, it won't be long before those chickens will be all together in a flock in a relatively small area. Same thing with sheep. We have a small flock of sheep, and they will generally travel together as a flock. And they do this, they come to this decision by instinct. Well, there are also laws of human behavior. Humans didn't invent these laws of human behavior, but they simply discover them. And then we are all subject to these laws of human behavior, even if we don't discover them until later. Well, there's a law of human behavior called the Pareto Principle, P-A-R-E-T-O, the Pareto Principle. We also know it as the 80-20 rule. This was, and I teach this law of human behavior, the Pareto Principle, to my economic students, to my government students, and the U.S. history classes, because it affects almost everything we do. And this Pareto Principle, the 80-20 rule, also affects us within the Church of God. Part of the understanding of the Pareto Principle is awareness of the Pareto distribution. Now, I might explain about this Pareto Principle. And that is, 20% of something is responsible for 80% of the results. So, in a classroom of 25 students, 20% is 5 students. 5 students will be the top ones. They're going to outshine everyone. 5 students will be the most difficult ones to handle. They're on the other end of the 20% range. And so this principle of human behavior is true, just as true as gravity. And it was discovered then by Pareto, who was a fellow who discovered, after Italy was united into a country in the late 1800s, in 1861, he discovered that 80% of the land was owned by 20% of the people. And then he started, and there was another then a fellow who took on this a scientist named Juran in America. He was actually a Romanian by birth, and he was an engineer and a human engineer, in that he was an efficiency expert. Why do things work the way they do? And he was the one that named this discovery of Pareto Principle and applied it to more areas of life. So why do people do what they do, and why do they do this in predictable manner, or predictable fashion? Let's turn to Matthew 26, verse 11. In Matthew 26, verse 11, it's a simple verse, 2 short phrases put together. For you have the poor with you always, but me you do not have always. This is Christ saying to his disciples that, you know, they wanted to go out and take care of the poor, but he said, you always will have the poor. Well, that's an interesting thing. You know, I felt poor for a lot of my life, you know, and I'm thinking, well, yeah, I can identify with that part. But then he said, me you do not have always. Now, bear in mind, what we in the United States think is poor is really richer than most people in the world. Most of the poor people in America have cell phones, cable TV, perhaps a big screen television. Most of our poor have clothes to wear, food to eat. Everyone in America has access to emergency medical care in any hospital room in America. Well, so why do we still have poor among us? If we read carefully what Christ said about the poor, we'll realize Christ wasn't just talking about those who were physically rich or poor, but those who are spiritually rich or poor. And if we want to become spiritually rich, then we must take advantage of the spiritual opportunities before us. But not everyone responds to God's calling in the same way. Well, the Pareto principle explains this phenomenon of human behavior. Just as our financial situations are spread out through the whole range, it's called the Pareto distribution, across the economic spectrum, it's really the result of choices that we make individually. And then some of those things happen to choices made by others. They can interrupt our lives and make life difficult. And then our choice is, how do we respond to it? The same thing is true about our spiritual wealth. Some people are more diligent in their prayer and Bible study, meditation, and their outward expression of empathy for others. But the bottom line is, all people will appear individually before God. If we take a look at 2 Corinthians 5, and verses 9 and 10. In 2 Corinthians 5, verses 9 and 10. Apostle Paul is writing to the church in Corinth, and he says, "Therefore, we make it our aim, whether present or absent, to be well-pleasing to him," meaning to God, "for we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that each one may receive the things done in the body," meaning done in the church or in the body of Christ, "according to what he has done, whether good or bad." So each person, it says each one. It didn't say the group will receive the positive or negative benefits. It says each one of us will appear before Christ and give account according to what we've done, regardless of what we've done or not done. Notice that Paul is pointing out here, we do have this individual responsibility. And significantly, we're not being judged on what someone else said or did. If we turn to Hebrews 4 and verses 14 and 15. We do have the time of the judgment, and we have the benefit of having some help when we come before the judgment seat. In Hebrews 4, verses 14 and 15. "For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but was in all points tempted as we are, yet without sin." Christ went through the human life circumstances, running into all these kinds of complications, whether it would be a challenge on the Sabbath, a challenge on the work situation, a challenge with relationships to others, others having disputes around us. Christ had all that experience, and yet without sin. Verse 16, Hebrews 4, "Let us therefore come boldly to the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and find grace and help in time of need." We can ask God when things aren't working out so well that we need some help. And we all do, because all of us are less than perfect. If we look at 1 John, "My little children, these things I write to you so that you may not sin. And if anyone sins, we have an advocate in the Father, Jesus Christ, the righteous." Isn't that what we just read back from, we're reading what John wrote. Now we're reading from back when the author of Hebrews wrote. "And he himself," meaning Christ, "is a propitiation for our sins." He paid the price. "And not for ours only, but the whole world." Propitiation is an appeasement from anger or consequence. So Christ was there to help us through and pay the penalty when we don't cut it. Now there is a test. The test is, there's a way that we can know whether or not we are known favorably to God. "Now by this that we know him, if we keep his commandments." Well, that's a simple test. If Jesus Christ is our advocate, and he's at the right hand of God the Father, and we are being judged before God, Jesus Christ, who knows the situation that we were in, can advocate for us. But what gives him evidence? What gives him evidence of our conversion? But now, by this, we know that we know him if we keep his commandments. We will know inside. We will, in other words, we know that we know him. And of course, every year at the Passover season, we read John 15, verse 10. In John 15, 10, if you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love, just as I've kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love. This expectation is not a group test. It's an individual test. This is an individual responsibility. And when a number of like-minded individuals are each seeking to abide in the love of God by keeping God's commandments, then that group becomes part of the Church of God. From time to time, I hear the people bash the concept of individualism with the implication that collectivism is a better path to follow. So let's take a look, and Merriam-Webster has a definition of individualism: a doctrine that the interests of the individual or ought to be ethically paramount. A theory maintaining the political and economic independence of the individual and stressing individual initiative, action, and interests. So doing what you need to do first, putting that first, I might note that those who decry individualism often conflate or mix up individualism with what we call narcissism. And you may have heard of this narcissism idea. And that's when a person, an individualism is when a person's concerned with his or her own interests, but it doesn't exclude others. Narcissism is a psychological pathology in which a person disregards others. Narcissism isn't individualism. Narcissism is a disregard to others, whereas individualism is learning to take responsibility for oneself. A few years ago, I had a student in the classroom, and she came into the classroom, and somebody had dropped a ring from a previous class. And the new student came in and says, "Oh, look, I like that ring," and picked it up and put it on her finger. And I thought, well, that's nice. And I thought, well, now she's going to give it back, or here, can you find yours? No. I said, that's somebody else's ring. It's mine now. There was no thought whatsoever about this being somebody else's property, returning it to them, no concept of what it means to steal. Well, over time, and this was very annoying until I had to insist. And then later on, it was later in the school year, the temperature, when we were building a new campus, we were in temporary classrooms, and the heat regulation wasn't always the way it should be. And this same student asked to borrow my jacket. Well, it was in class. Fine. If you don't want to get too cold, you can borrow my jacket. That's fine. And then went home with it. Didn't bring it back. And it was a kind of a rain jacket, a nylon Arkansas Razorback jacket. And I said, what? So I went home without my jacket. And I bear in mind. And the next day, the student comes to school, has her own little decorative girl jacket on, and not mine. And I said, where's my jacket? Oh, I liked it, so I kept it. Well, that's nice. She made the mistake of taking her jacket off. And when I locked her jacket in the drawer, she said, I want my jacket back. And I said, when you bring mine back, you can have yours back. Harumph. And the next day she showed up with my jacket back, and I gave her own back. There was no concept of the concern or regard for other people, their feelings, their thoughts, or their property. I would venture to say that person would test out pretty high on the narcissism scale without regard to others. Let's turn to Philippians 2:4. So I don't want us to conflate individualism with narcissism. And Philippians 2:4 speaks to this very issue. Philippians 2:4, let each of you look out not only for his own interests, but also for the interests of others. So what does it say first? you look out for your own interests. But don't stop there. Give your thought, your mindset, your heart, show love to others by looking out for the interests of others. Does it say disregard your own interests to the exclusion of only looking out for others? No, it doesn't say that. This individual responsibility beyond oneself is demonstrated throughout the Bible. If we take a look in Exodus, we know there was the children of Israel came out of Egypt. And then we have the book of Numbers that is about their wandering in the wilderness and they're coming upon the promised land, the land of Canaan, after getting out of Egypt. And a number starting in Numbers 13, and I'm going to pick out a few verses in Numbers 13, starting in verse 1. And this is where Moses was sending out the spies. In Numbers 13:1, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, send men to spy out the land of Canaan, which I am giving to the children of Israel. From each tribe of their fathers you shall send a man, every one a leader among them. So each tribe had to select someone to investigate as the spies. And of course, we read on in chapter 13 that each of the spies, the 12 spies, each representing 12 tribes, spied out the land. And 10 of them came back with a report that said there's a lot of stuff there, but it's way too scary. I mean, we'll just never be able to deal with this. There's giants, you know, and the people would overwhelm us. It would never work out. And in Numbers 13, verse 30 and 31, we have Caleb, I'm turning there, but Caleb spoke about the bounty of the land and said, let's go up. We're easily able to occupy it. But the people wanted to stone them, the Joshua and Caleb, who gave a good report. Imagine that. If somebody stood up here and gave you a message of optimism, and everybody said, let's stone them, meaning we'll kill them, because we're too afraid. We're afraid of what? We're afraid of the obstacles before us, and we don't want to hear about it. What Caleb did is he quieted the crowd and said, look, after the 10 spoke, he spoke and said, look, all this is a land of milk and honey, grapes that it takes two men to haul them back. And we can do this. You know, God has given it to us. And they were beside themselves and actually wanted to kill the messenger. Here in Numbers 14 and verse 6, Joshua also spoke and told the rich bounty of the land. And the people wanted to stone him too. So you have Joshua and Caleb, the only two of the 12 that spoke up and said, let's do this. And we read on in Numbers 14 in verses 29 through 38, and I'll just summarize, that the complainers, the ones that were afraid, were afflicted by a plague, and they, God personally prevented them from entering the promised land for 40 years. One year for every day that the spies spied out in the land of Canaan. So a year for a day of exploration. So at the end of 40 years, all of those people that were the complainers would die in the wilderness. Their children would go in to the promised land, except Joshua and Caleb and their families, okay? Because they were not among the complainers who said, we can't do this. Prior to the individual responsibility that was assumed by them, Joshua and Caleb, who stood up for reality, we can read the stories of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Each one of them was individually responsible, and we call them a patriarch for the reason, the fathers of the tribe of Israel. And some of the lessons that we've learned that are throughout the Bible is that everyone will have to bear his own burden. You can't shove it off onto other people. Well, I'm guilty, but you have to pay the price, and so forth. Let's turn to Galatians 6:5. In Galatians 6:5, for each one will bear his own load. For each one will bear his own load. And we'll turn then to, and that, you know, we would think that that would be self-explanatory. So let's turn to Romans 15 and verse 1 and give some explanation to bearing our own load, but we don't stop there. Because bearing our own load is just means you get what you pay for, you know. You put forth the effort, you put forth the burden, you're going to get the results of carrying that burden. You will get the benefit or the detriment of doing that. In Romans 15 and verse 1, then we who are strong ought to bear with the scruples of the weak and not to please ourselves, meaning don't limit us bearing the burdens. Verse 2, let's each of us please his neighbor for his own good, leading to edification. So we need to step up, and each one bearing our own load, but that isn't the end of it. We as individuals are required as Christians to bear up with others. And as they say, many hands make a light load. Many hands make a light burden. Let's turn to Galatians, back to Galatians 6. In Galatians 6, let's start in verse 1. In Galatians 6, 1. Brethren, if a man is overtaken in any trespass, read sin, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness, considering yourself, lest you also be tempted. Verse 2, bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. What did they say the law of Christ was? Who mirrored the law of God? Loving others as what? As we love ourselves. So bearing one another's burdens, showing love to one another. Verse 3, for if anyone thinks himself to be something when he is nothing, in other words, falsely thinking that you're all it, when he is nothing, he deceives himself. But let each one examine his own work, and then you have rejoicing in himself alone and not in another. In other words, rejoice for what you can do. Be proud or pleased with what you can do. And then it says, for each shall bear his own load. And it goes on, let him who has taught the word share in all good things with him who teaches. Do not be deceived, for God is not mocked. Whatever a man sows, that will he also reap. So when Galatians says each one will bear his own load, that can be for benefit, meaning for positive, or it could be you're going to earn your consequences. As we read here what Paul wrote about reaping what we sow. Then we can turn to 1 Timothy 5. 1 Timothy 5 and verse 8. Individually, we have a responsibility. You may have heard of somebody saying it takes a village. But individually, we have a responsibility. In 1 Timothy 5, verse 8, if anyone does not provide for his own, and especially for those of his household, he's denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. So we have individual responsibility to look after our own family and providing for our own, whether it's our individual family, household in particular. Meaning, you can talk the talk, but are you going to walk the walk, or are you going to deny the faith? Because God is really ranking here. It says, worse than an unbeliever, because you've thrown it over. You've chosen not to do something. But if an individual makes a mistake and they don't do what they should, we read in Deuteronomy 24:16 what the consequences are if people don't do what they should. In Deuteronomy 24 and verse 16. Deuteronomy 24:16, fathers shall not be put to death for their sons, nor shall sons be put to death for their fathers. Everyone shall be put to death for his own sin. This is an individual consequence to an individual responsibility. It doesn't say the opposite. Imagine you take the knots out of there. Fathers shall be put to death for their sons, and sons shall be put to death for their fathers, and everyone shall be put to death for everyone else's sin. Makes absolutely no sense in context with Christianity. So bear in mind, we're looking at an individual responsibility. Job, who went through great agony and great difficulty. And how many times in our life when we've been in the pits and we're dragged down and whatever the life circumstances were, and we think of Job. And Job said in 19 verse 4, in Job of 19 verse 4, even if I have truly erred, my error lodges with me. He was taking personal responsibility. If I've done anything wrong, and it tells us Job was righteous, but he said, if I've done something wrong, it's my own fault. I'm not blaming now somebody else. The error is with me. You know how hard it is to get a student to say that out loud? The error is with me. Why, they're just like adults that way. Always ready to blame someone else. Let someone else pay the price. In Proverbs 9 and verse 12, if you are wise, you are wise for yourself. And if you scoff, you alone will bear it. In other words, you will suffer if you make good decisions, make wise decisions, or you will benefit if you make wise decisions, and you will suffer if you scoff or become an unbeliever of whatever it is that's true, whatever is reality. You can discount reality, sort of like rubbing poison ivy on your face and saying, it doesn't bother me. Well, you alone will bear it. Okay? Let's take a look at Ezekiel 18:20. And what I want to do today is impress upon us that our lives are individual responsibility. In Ezekiel 18, verse 20, the person who sins will die. Now, where was Ezekiel reading this? Didn't we read this back in Deuteronomy? So what do you suppose Ezekiel was reading? He was reading the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible. The son will not bear the punishment for the father's iniquity, nor will the father bear the punishment for the son's iniquity. The righteousness of the righteous will be upon himself, and the wickedness of the wicked be upon himself. So we have this repetition throughout the Bible to remind us, to help us to focus on our individual responsibilities, which follows by individual rewards and consequences that may be less than happy, and some, in fact, may be joyful. As they say, if you want a sense of power, you know, some people like money, and some people like authority. But if you want a real sense of power, grow your own tomato. They say that gives a lot of satisfaction. In Romans 14, verse 4, it's always easy for us to point out what other people are doing wrong. I'm really good at it. Just ask my kids. Pointing out what somebody did wrong. Of course, I like to think that I'm trying to guide and mold them and direct them in their way, but then they grow up and they do the same with their own children. And in Romans 14:4, we read, who are you to judge the servant of another? To his own master he stands or falls, and he'll stand for the and he will stand, for the Lord is able to make him stand. It's somebody else's responsibility. Whoever that person reports to, it's their boss that's going to have to decide if that's good enough or not good enough. It's not up to us to go, yoo-hoo, I see something over there across the street. That person is responsible to their supervisor. And if they need help, God is certainly able to provide that help. In Romans 14, we move on in verse 10. For we will all stand before the judgment seat of God, so then each of us will give an account of himself to God. So we're going to stand, what, in a group? Will all of us appear together at the judgment seat of God? Or are we reading that each one of us will stand alone in that spot? Now, I work for a government bureaucracy. Maybe some of you work for a government bureaucracy. We all have to deal with them. And as a result, I get to see things inside of a bureaucracy that happen. Doesn't matter whether it's private or public or what it is. But if there's a difficult decision to be made, what do you suppose school principals do? They form a committee or an advisory group. And this committee or advisory group then comes up with whatever the principal wants them to say. And then the decision is made based upon the inspiration and suggestion of the advisory group. And those of us who have been around a while and know how the world works, we recognize that you appoint a committee, then you can escape personal responsibility. It works the same way for collectivism, for collectives. Instead of individualism on one hand, you have collectivism on the other, because collectivisms, if there's something goes wrong, it spreads the guilt out, so that when everyone is, if everybody's responsible, then nobody is guilty. Nobody's responsible for that. So remember Philippians 2 and verse 1, and I'll just quote it. We've read it already. Look not only after your own interest, but also to the interest of others. So we have people who are then calling for, and I hear it constantly, they're calling for collectivism. And what the problem is, even in the church, and they conflate or mix up or compare collectivism with cooperation. Well, helping each other is not the same as collective ownership. We all help each other. I was just on a visit to my family's Pioneer Homestead in Minnesota, still owns it in the family. And there stands the house that was built in the 1880s that my brother lives in, one of my brothers. There stands the barn that was rebuilt in 1904. And it was built into the side of a hill with stone foundation. And then they put a roof on this. So in Minnesota, it gets cold in the winter. I know that's new to some of you. And by building it half into a hill, you have now the ground temperature, so which is warmer than above in the air. And so you have some warmth in the barn. And what they did is, after a number of years, they raised the roof on the barn by using horses and beams, and they built and put walls underneath the roof and raised it up in the air about 14 feet, certainly over 10 feet, that much I know. And they raised it up in the air so that there was a huge hay storage area up in this haymow. My great-grandfather did not do this alone. Everybody in the neighborhood came and helped for that project. And as I was driving my daughter around, showing her the various farms of the family members, and I said, you will notice they all have a barn that looks just like that one. They were all built or rebuilt for that style. And when anybody needed to put up a project, the neighbors all came and they built this project together. That's called cooperation. They didn't all own that barn. They cooperated in building that barn. So we can't conflate or confuse cooperation with collectivism. They each owned their own barn. And when it was time to help out, then they would go help somebody else. It was a big social event when it was done. Pies were baked. They would roll out a beer barrel. There were a lot of and they held a barn dance in each of the barns that were done. It was a huge thing, and of course, it was done in the summer. Today, we see the same kind of mindset in the Amish community, where the whole community will get together, but individuals still own individual things. So helping each other isn't the same as collective ownership. Those who call for collectivism then say, well, an example of collectivism is the family. Yet the family is the basic unit that God designed. And then when the children become adults, guess what happens? They are now individuals responsible for themselves. We read, the father is not responsible for the child, nor the child for the parents. And when they become adults, they become responsible. For better or worse, you did the best you could with what you had at the time. Now they have to be responsible for their own decisions. So this family unit is meant for the nurturing or the care to bring up the child within that family. Then there are those who call collectivism, they conflate it collectivism with tribes. Well, we have a tribe, so that's an example of collectivism. And then they will even pick up the Bible and point that out and say, well, Let's just take a look. Well, there were tribes that were allocated land coming out of the promised land, and God told Moses to or Joshua to set it out so that each tribe would have its land. But then they stopped there. They didn't go on. But if they would have read the entire context, individuals within each tribe had a geographic area. Individual families owned the property within that area. Well, how do we know that? Let's turn to Leviticus 25. Leviticus 25. In Leviticus 25, and the Lord, starting in verse 1, the Lord spoke to Moses on Mount Sinai, "Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when you come into the land which I give you, then the land shall keep a Sabbath for the Lord." And it goes on to describe the seventh year land Sabbath. And then it goes on to verse 11, "The 50th year shall be a jubilee to you." And it goes on to explain the rules of that jubilee in verse 13 of Leviticus 25. "In this year of jubilee, each of you shall return his possession. And if you sell anything to your neighbor or buy from your neighbor's hand, you shall not repress one another." In other words, being responsible, but returning his possession is referring to the land. The land was to be kept within the family that it was originally allocated. And if it was sold, it could only be sold and subject to redemption, giving back at the end of 50 years. So how many 50-year cycles in an average person's life as an adult? Once. You have a chance to blow it for your family. Life can be hard. You can mess up. You may have to sell. And what's the value of the property? It's worth however many productive seasons there are until you get to the year 50. It's not like we value land today in that it has a fixed value and depending upon the productivity of the land forever. It is only the productivity for the property to jubilee year, and then it goes back to the family that lost it or that sold it in the beginning. And so it's not wrong or bad to sell something, but bear in mind there probably was a reason to do so. And so in verse 15, "According to the number of years of the jubilee, you shall buy from your neighbor. According to the number of years of crops, he shall sell to you." In other words, how many in the future? So it's an individual ownership that we're looking at here with regard, it's not tribe. The tribes are simply designated as to who's going to live where within that tribe. If we look at the definition of collectivism, under dictionary.com, it says collectivism is a political principle of centralized social and economic control, especially of all means of production. And Merriam-Webster calls collectivism a political or economic theory advocating collective control, especially over production and distribution. Well, as an economist and a historian, I can document that every system in the world that has relied on collectivism over individualism has failed miserably. People become impoverished, often dying of sickness and malnutrition. That goes back to early America as well. The Plymouth Bay Colony, when they landed or came from Europe in 1619, the next year they set up a colony, the Plymouth Bay Colony in Massachusetts. William Bradford set it up. And you know what they decided? We'll do collectivism. We'll just all contribute and then we'll take out as we need. What happened? They starved. Why? Because not everybody wanted to get up in the morning and go out and plant crops. They were all there to harvest, but they weren't all quite so willing to help their neighbor. As nice of people as they were, there was no incentive for production. Finally, William Bradford said, "You know what? If you don't work, you won't eat." And along with that, he allocated pieces of private property for each person or each family. And they said, "It's up to you. If you want to eat, farm, you know, take care of your own garden, produce your own stuff. And if you don't, well, then if you don't work, you won't eat." It'll be a natural consequence. We have now modern consequences to the same thing. And those modern consequences, those of us uh, that uh, that remember the world before 1991 know about the Soviet Union, where they dominated much of Central Asia, Eastern Europe, and the countries of Eastern Europe. And that includes where I've spent some time in Estonia, and then Latvia and Lithuania, Ukraine, and other Eastern European countries. And the Soviet Union dominated. And what was the consequence of this collective ownership? Lack of individual responsibility. What happened? You had developed a developed sense of hopelessness. People turned to alcohol. There was increased alcoholism. There was an increase in depression and suicides. You would take a look at the buildings that were dilapidated. They weren't. There was no pride of ownership, as it were. There was a lack of housing. People who got married had to wait to become allocated for a place to live. So there might be three or more generations living in one place, cramped quarters, because of the lack of individual opportunity. There was a lack of wealth accumulation under a collectivist system. And we see other examples, such as Cuba. You want to take a look at poverty? Go to Cuba, or North Korea, or Venezuela. And each of these failed economies, they cast out individualism, and they adopted collectivism. You know what else they threw out? In every case, they threw out the Bible. Because what does the Bible teach, as we've just been reading? Individual responsibility. And if you throw out individual responsibility, then you have, you're left with the collectivism and the power of the state. And ultimately, what that means is that the collectivist power has the power of life and death over you. So this power of death means if you don't comply, we will kill you. And that was proven in the 1900s, the 20th century, where these collectivist economies, and I've gone there and seen the results of it firsthand, and some of you have too, is that they've killed over 100 million of their own people because they had totalitarianism. Because people don't willingly give up their stuff. What do you mean you're going to take what I have? Go get your own stuff. But when the government does, then people want to are compelled at the cost of their life. What do we learn from the Bible about individualism? It goes right to the Ten Commandments. If we take a look at Exodus 20 or Deuteronomy 5, what do we read? Don't steal other people's stuff. Well, that means other people own stuff. You can't take it from them if nobody owns anything. I guess that commandment, we can throw that one out if we have collectivism, because there is no such thing as stealing, because no, everybody owns everything. Then it says, don't bear false witness against your neighbor. Well, what does lying matter? If you're trying to gain an advantage over someone else, to accumulate something in particular, then so bearing false witness against your neighbor doesn't matter. What about don't murder? So does a person own his own life? We're each responsible for ourselves, but under collectivism, death is not that big of a deal. In the Soviet Empire prior to 1991, the leading country for abortions was Romania. More abortions than births. Phenomenal. And because there was a sense of hopelessness. What's the use of procreating another generation? And so and what was the value of older people? They're useless, so we'll move them on. We won't collect from them their life stories. What can they contribute? The wisdom that will pass on to the next generation. So murdering wasn't that big of a deal. You've probably seen the pictures, as I have, about anybody who didn't do what the state wanted, lined up in front of a trench, and they shot them in the back of the head. If you take a look at the killing fields of Cambodia, where they forcibly depopulated the urban centers in Cambodia, and up to 7 million people were killed. It was just like wherever they were, get up and march. City people go out in the country into this collectivist nightmare. Really, it's all based upon another commandment that says, don't covet other people's stuff. Well, when somebody doesn't have something, you look across the street or across the field at somebody who's got something a little nicer. Do we follow the commands of the Bible on individual responsibility, or should we rely on someone else to commit murder so we can get their stuff? You say, well, they're not going to actually kill anybody. Well, that's sort of like when I was a lad, my grandfather was telling me, who grew up in the pre-tractor, pre-electricity days, and he said, a horse was someone's life. Your horse is how you made a living. It's how you could plow the land. If you lost your horse, somebody was condemning you to death. So that's why stealing somebody's horse was basically incrementally committing murder against that family because they lost the means of production. Now they would be, living like cavemen days, where they didn't have the use of that technology. Don't covet other people's stuff, whether it's their mates, the stuff they have that you want. Don't do that. And so we have the Ten Commandments that give us individual responsibilities to carry out, each one of us. We take a look at 1 Kings 4 and verse 25. 1 Kings 4, verse 25. And there was a time of peace during the time when Solomon was king. How do they describe here in 1 Kings 4, verse 25, about the time of Solomon's rule? And Judah and Israel dwelt safely, each man under his vine and his fig tree, from Dan to Beersheba, from the south to the north, all the days of Solomon. Notice it says, each man under his vine and fig tree. It didn't say, under their collective vines and fig trees, and you all go harvest as best you can. No, it was everybody felt safe. They weren't being subject to thieves and murder in a sad sense that the country was overrun with grief. But each to his own individual vine and fig tree, in other words, the means of production. Let's go ahead and look at the kingdom of God, what that's going to be like in Micah 4, verse 4. In Micah 4, verse 4, we read about the past at that time of peace under King Solomon. In Micah 4, 4, we read this about the coming kingdom of God. But everyone shall sit under his vine and under his fig tree, and no one shall make them afraid, for the mouth of the Lord of hosts had spoken. Well, what would you be afraid of? Murder, lies, coveting, stealing? No. Just like as in the reign of Solomon, that time of peace where people would be able to eat their own produce and be comforted and saved in it. And does it say here that each man could complain about how little his vine and fig tree grew compared to the others? No, it said there was peace, okay, that they were each being able to be productive. So if we take a look, I thought a good title for this message is Individualism is a Christian Responsibility. Individualism, a Christian responsibility. We've looked at what has happened over the years, how there hasn't been in the past the same kind of responsibility, individual responsibility, but this whole awakening of the Renaissance or the Enlightenment and the understanding of the Pareto principle, the 80-20 rule, we'll always have people that will be spread out over every level because we can go to look at Luke 12 and look at the parable of the talents, and different people have different productive capacities. I am not an opera singer. I don't know how to weave a rug. I can't paint much of a picture, although I painted a couple. They're suspiciously deficient. There are a lot of things. I don't know how to make shoes. I'm learning how to grow a tomato. Okay. But there are things that I can't do, and then there are things that I can do. And we read throughout the Bible, and it's reinforced throughout history, that when people do things for themselves and take individual responsibility, then God will reward them with positive things for the positive things they do, and people reap the consequences if they do something negative. The laws of nature are there. If we fling ourselves off the building, as I did when I was 10 years old, thinking the ground was much closer than what it was, you learn that the ground comes up pretty fast. And I did jump. Thankfully, I landed on soft soil. But I learned the consequence of gravity. And all of these decisions that people make are subject to the laws of human behavior that are described in the Bible. Now, of course, we all screw up from time to time, or we fail to follow up. And those who are converted and following Christ and wish to keep his commands, we have an advocate to help us to get through the tough times and to stand beside us to be our advocate at the judgment seat. So our job is to be responsible for ourselves and then help our neighbors. But we can't help our neighbor unless first we accept the responsibility given to us by God, both as a physical and a spiritual responsibility. And if we're looking at the Abrahamic blessing, we're really looking at reading the Bible and doing what God says. And if you do what God says, you are going to reap both physical and spiritual benefits. Every person in this room is wealthy. By every measure of human existence in the last 5,000 to 6,000 years of human history. And the result of that is because we have dedicated ourselves to understanding what God expects of each one of us. So if we were to sum it up, and I heard this somewhere, and I don't know where to quote it, about individualism being a Christian responsibility, it's simply this. If it is to be, it is up to me.